Hello and welcome to this Lexis webinar on the latest tax cases from 2021. I'm Sarah Bond, a partner in the tax team at Freshfields, specialising in tax disputes, including investigations and litigation. Let me hand you over to my co-speaker to introduce himself.
Hi, I'm Rupert Shires. I am also a partner that deals with difficult conversations with HMRC, and I do that at the international law firm Hogan Lovells.
Together, we have chosen some cases to discuss that we think are of interest from a corporate tax perspective, as shown on the slides, and we'll explain why that is as we come on to each of them. They cover quite a range of different topics, so hopefully there's something of interest to everyone. The first few we're going to cover in more detail, and the others at a higher level, as unfortunately we don't have time today to go through them all in detail. I'm going to hand over to Rupert now to kick us off with QuickFit.
This is the first of two cases dealing with HMRC's interest in the purpose of transactions. And Sarah's going to deal with another one next. These rules have been around, I'm sad to say, I'm old enough to know, for around 25 years. And for perhaps the first 20, there was relatively little use of them by HMRC and certainly little or no case law on them, and some uncertainty as to how the legislation applied in detail. We're now seeing a flurry of cases and some consistencies emerging. What's striking about QuickFit is how the legislation is applied to, frankly, pretty uncontroversial planning, and how far through the analysis you have to get to find a reason for any deduction to be allowed at all. So, skipping onto the first QuickFit slide, HMRC challenged, as I've said, deductibility of interest expense on intragroup debt under the unallowable purpose test in section 441 of CTA 2009. A network of intercompany balances had arisen over time just through day-to-day dealings in the QuickFit group. One entity, an intermediate holdco called Speedy One, that had been put on top as part of a previous acquisition, had significant carried forward losses. Under a reorganisation, loan receivables were transferred to Speedy One. Interest rates went up to LIBOR plus 5%, said to be arm's length, come back to that. And Speedy One made a number of additional loans to allow the reorganisation to take effect. A main purpose of the reorganisation, perhaps the main purpose, but the tribunal said a main purpose, was to allow Speedy One to use its carry forward relief, which, because of the reorganisation, the model was it could do it within 3 years rather than 25 years. HMRC didn't like this, and they denied interest deductions each year to the extent of the carried forward relief used. So we'll go on to the next slide. For the unallowable purpose rules to apply, there must be a tax advantage, and obtaining that must be a main purpose for the borrower to be party to the loan. The legislation talks about a tax avoidance purpose, but I think it's clear there's no subjective threshold of whether we're talking about naughty avoidance as opposed to appropriate planning. You just look for a tax advantage, and that in turn is defined to include looking for whether a relief is generated or used. In QuickFit, there was interest expense for the debtor companies, and there was relief of interest receipts by the non-trading deficit in Speedy One. Those were both tax advantages. There's no need for a comparator transaction, no need to go looking for an advantage compared to what. That was the question. And the tribunal endorsed the Oxford Instruments view, we'll talk a little bit more about that case in a minute, that straightforward borrowing can still give rise to a tax advantage. Pre-existing loans were found to retain their commercial purpose that had arisen when they were intercompany balances. The tax purpose of the reorganisation, though, was in effect attributed to those loans as an additional main purpose, partly because all the companies had agreed to participate. But increasing the rate of interest on the loans was really important. I think it was important to HMRC, and it was definitely important to the tribunal. QuickFit said that this was just to comply with transfer pricing rules, but this wasn't accepted. A key point being that there didn't seem to be consistent evidence of transfer pricing rules being applied on all the loans, even all the loans under consideration. So the pre-existing loans had a tax main purpose and a non-tax main purpose. The new loans had only a tax main purpose. So I'll go on to the last quick fix slide. If you have mixed main purposes, the final step is to allocate the debits between the purposes, and the part allocated to tax main purpose is disallowed. In Oxford Instruments, Tribunal Judge Tony Beer had said that you apply a but-for test. Only the debits which wouldn't exist but for tax avoidance purposes are to be disallowed. The tribunal here didn't want to change the statutory test. They wanted to leave room for other things, but actually in reality, they applied a but-for test. And the outcome was no interest deduction on new loans, no deduction for the increased rate on pre-existing loans, and as I've said, subject to a cap on disallowance of the amount of the carried forward losses used. Now, it's only a tribunal decision, but I think what's important is that it's a part of the pattern, we're really seeing these rules being applied by the tribunal, even to pretty vanilla planet, and you just have to work your way through. That's it on QuickFit.
Rupert, what do you think about the tribunal's decision on that just and reasonable apportionment piece in the QuickFit case?
So I think it's a good question. I think they're right not to make but for the test and to have it just as a touchstone. I think if they had believed that QuickFit were just getting their transfer pricing right, I don't think we'd have had the disallowance on the top up. I think the real feature of this case is that one way or another, QuickFit didn't persuade the tribunal that was what they were doing. Sarah, over to you.
Thanks, Rupert. So I'm going to talk about another case on purposes, but in a different context, which is the Euromoney decision, another first-tier tribunal decision, which focuses on rollover relief under section 135 of the TCGA on a share-for-share exchange. And in that context, purpose comes up in the anti-avoidance rule in section 137(1), which applies to prevent rollover treatment if a share exchange forms part of a scheme or arrangements with a main purpose of avoiding a liability to corporation tax. And it's an interesting case, I think, because of the conclusion that notwithstanding there was a tax purpose, the anti-avoidance rule did not apply. So if we start with a quick look at the facts, which are shown in the diagram on the first slide talking about euro money, you can see there that the makeup of the group as it stood initially, essentially a joint venture between Euromoney PLC on the one hand and DTL or the Dealogic PLC group on the other hand. And what happened was that a private equity group was looking to purchase the Dealogic PLC group, company rather, and also made an offer for Euromoney's shares in CDL and CNL, the two joint venture companies, so that the PE group could take control of the whole lot. And the deal that was originally struck was that Euromoney would dispose of its shareholdings in those two companies in exchange for a package of consideration, which in each case comprised a shareholding of ordinary shares in DTL and a cash amount. And it was important to Euromoney to hold those ordinary shares in DTL going forward, so that it could realise or benefit from any increase in value in the DL group, because it was expecting that it would. The problem was that in relation to the disposal by Euromoney of CDL, that cash element would give rise to a tax liability for it, a capital gain. So Euromoney's tax director spotted this and suggested as an alternative that instead of paying partly cash for the CDL shares, instead, they would seek to agree that Euromoney would get an issue of redeemable preference shares from DTL, as well as the ordinary shares it was already expecting to get. And the idea was that rollover relief would then be available for all of the gain on the CDL shares. And if Euromoney held those preference shares for long enough, it would qualify for the substantial shareholdings exemption on a future disposal of those shares because of its separate ordinary shareholding. And that is indeed what happened. So before the transaction completed, Euromoney applied for clearance that the anti-avoidance rule didn't apply under section 138 TCGA. but didn't receive that clearance in time before the transaction completed. And as it happened, clearance was refused, but Euromoney still filed its return on the basis that the Section 135 relief was available. So the significant points, I think, from this decision are what it says about arrangements of which the share exchange forms part and the purposes of those arrangements. And a few key points are set out on the next slide. So on the arrangement side of things, HMRC took the position that the arrangements should be construed narrowly and were only those relating to the preference shares, by which I mean replacing the cash consideration that was originally agreed to be payable for the CDL shares with the redeemable preference shares in DTL that could be held until a disposal of those would benefit from the SSE. And the taxpayer argued for a broader view of arrangements, encompassing the wider commercial arrangements of the transaction. So Euromoney's arm's length disposal of its shareholdings and its intention to hold the ordinary shares in DTL in expectation of being able to benefit from an increase in value of those. As you'll be able to see from the quotes on the slide, the first tier tribunal preferred the taxpayer's view on this following an earlier House of Lords decision in the Brebner case. So the tribunal said that the scheme or arrangements must be considered as a whole rather than considering one element in isolation from the others. And to identify the arrangements in this particular appeal as those concerning only the preference shares would give a wholly distorted view of the circumstances because the preference shares formed only a comparatively small part of the consideration. Moving on to the purposes question, that is one which is heavily dependent on the witness evidence and findings of fact in any given case, as it was in QuickFit. Here, the taxpayer acknowledged and accepted that the change in the deal from the cash element to preference share consideration was tax motivated. But a really important point was that the findings of fact made by the tribunal, largely based on the evidence of Euromoney's tax director, was that the tax saving generated by that switch from cash to prefs was a nice to have, and the deal would have gone ahead anyway if it had not been possible to negotiate that change. And that's also reflected in the fact that they went ahead with the deal, even though they hadn't yet received the Section 138 clearance. The First Tier Tribunal's view was that in determining main purposes, the key question is what Euromoney's subjective intentions were. Again, that's a point that's common to purpose tests generally. But in this case, in light of its findings of fact, the First Tier Tribunal concluded that avoiding a liability to tax was one of the purposes of the arrangements as a whole, but it was not a main purpose of Euromoney. And so they allowed the taxpayer's appeal. There are some broader points, I think, that this case raises, which are set out on the next slide. One is the importance to the decision of that piece around the scope of what the arrangements were. Because if a narrower view had been taken by the tribunal, the commercial purposes that were found to be the main purposes of the arrangements simply wouldn't have been relevant because both parties accepted that Euromoney only had a tax purpose as regards that switch from cash to preference share consideration. But on a broader view of the arrangements, the tax purpose was held not to be a main purpose, and that's quite significant.
So, Sarah, it's interesting because this isn't the same, I think, as the approach taken on other facts in other cases. Can you tell us a bit about your thoughts on how this compares with other cases on purpose-based tests?
Well, I think it does contrast with other decisions on and purpose tests in other areas, including the unallowable purpose test that you were talking about in relation to QuickFit. Because I think in particular that trend of cases you were referring to and the BlackRock decision, which preceded QuickFit, have found that there's a pretty low bar to finding a tax purpose. Although obviously in both contexts, the tribunal's looking to the subjective purposes of the company, which in practice means the intentions of the directors. And in both Euromoney and in the BlackRock case, it was critical to the taxpayer's appeal, which in both cases essentially succeeded, that the transaction in question would have been done anyway. So in Euromoney, that meant that tax was not treated as a main purpose. And in BlackRock, it meant that even though there was found to be a tax main purpose, applying that sort of but-for test to just and reasonable apportionment that you mentioned, none of the debits on the interest on the loan in that case were attributable to the tax purpose, and so they weren't disallowed, and the taxpayer essentially succeeded. One of the points probably worth mentioning is that in both of those cases, Euromoney and BlackRock, that point about the transaction having been done anyway came through primarily in the witness evidence. But I think it is a useful point for people to bear in mind when doing transactions, because it's always useful to have those kinds of points recorded in contemporaneous documents, which carry a lot of weight later on. It's probably also worth mentioning that Euromoney is under appeal. So there are further developments we can expect to see in that case. The next case we're going to talk about is the Supreme Court decision in Tooth. And that is a case about discovery assessments. There's a reminder on the slide of key elements that form part of the test for a discovery assessment to be issued. There needs to be a discovery, a loss of tax, and for that to have been brought about by the taxpayer, or in the case of a company, a person acting on their behalf, either carelessly or deliberately. And if those conditions are met, the general four-year deadline for an assessment to be issued is extended to 6 years in the case of careless behaviour, or 20 years if it's deliberate. Tooth involved an individual taxpayer, as it happens, but the principles that were established by this decision are equally applicable in the corporate tax context, I think. And there are a couple of important points that were covered, so I'll discuss those in order of what needs to be established for HMRC to issue an assessment. So first, what amounts to a discovery? Second, whether staleness would effectively negate the existence of a discovery? And finally, what amounts to deliberate behaviour in circumstances where there is an inaccuracy in a return? So on that discovery point, first of all, the background to the question here is that Mr. Tooth claimed a loss in his tax return, which arose from a tax avoidance scheme he'd participated in. And technical limitations of the software that he was using to complete his return meant the loss couldn't be included in the appropriate box. So it was knowingly entered into a different box, which led to the same outcome. That is, the loss was taken into account as a deduction from taxable income. And the white space on the return included a detailed explanation of what the loss was, why it had been dealt with in that way in the return, and acknowledging that Mr. Tooth's interpretation of the applicable law might be at variance with HMRC's, so it was assumed HMRC would open an inquiry. In those circumstances where Mr. Tooth had been upfront with HMRC about what he had done from the outset, was there any discovery? It's reasonably well established that discovery is also a pretty low bar. There is no need for any new information of fact or law to trigger a discovery, just that it newly appears to an HMRC officer that there is an insufficiency of tax. And that can be for any reason, including a change of view, change of opinion, correction of an oversight, further legal research, or new factual information. And it would also include a different officer taking over the file and reaching a different view from the previous officer, because there is no concept of collective HMRC knowledge in this context. None of those are really particularly new points, but nevertheless, it's worth flagging, I think, because the Supreme Court confirmed all of that in its decision. The staleness point is an interesting one, I think, because there had been a line of first-tier tribunal and upper tribunal cases leading up to this one, in which taxpayers had argued with varying degrees of success that for there to be a discovery, there must be some element of newness, that the newly appears point that I mentioned a few moments ago. And so the argument would go that HMRC should act on a discovery while it retained that quality of newness before it turned stale. And if HMRC failed to do that, so they didn't issue a discovery assessment within a reasonable period of time after having made the discovery, then it was argued that the discovery would no longer provide a basis for an assessment. So that argument was upheld in a couple of upper tribunal cases, as well as in some first-tier tribunal ones. But HMRC really did not like it and argued strenuously against it. The issue arose in Tooth because HMRC had asked some questions shortly after the return was originally filed in 2009, but didn't open any inquiry and only sought to reverse the claimed loss several years later with the discovery assessment. following a Supreme Court decision in another case concerning a different user of the same avoidance scheme. And Mr. Tooth argued that no relevant discovery had been made since 2009, and so the discovery was stale by the time that HMRC issued their assessment. The Supreme Court held, actually, that a discovery was made in 2014 when a new officer reviewed the file and then decided to issue a discovery assessment. So the question of staleness didn't actually arise on the facts in that case as they saw it. But they did take the opportunity to state clearly the Supreme Court's view that the legislative provisions simply don't admit a concept of staleness. A discovery does not cease to be a discovery through the passage of time. And that essentially sweeps away the case law from the lower courts around that concept. So what protection does a taxpayer have against a discovery assessment being made in light of that decision? The Supreme Court held that the taxpayer's primary safeguard is the statutory time limit within which HMRC have to make an assessment. And there is also a possibility of judicial review if HMRC have acted irrationally, for example, making a deliberate decision not to assess promptly. But there would have to be quite an extreme case, so it's fairly cold comfort to taxpayers. So clarification on the state of the law useful in that respect, but an HMRC-friendly change nevertheless. The most important point, though, probably relates to what amounts to a deliberate inaccuracy in a return, which is covered on the next slide. And that's because the Court of Appeal in Tooth had decided two things. First, that the requirement for an inaccuracy could be satisfied by looking at particular parts of the return rather than the whole thing together. And secondly, that for an inaccuracy to be deliberate, it was sufficient for there to be a deliberate, that is, intentional statement, which is inaccurate. And on that literal reading of the legislation, completing the return in a way which is known to be wrong, even if, as in Mr. Tooth's case, you explain why you've done that, and there was no intention to deceive or mislead HMRC in doing so, would be sufficient to push out the statutory time limit for a discovery assessment to 20 years. Combined with a low bar for discovery, that low bar for deliberate inaccuracy as well makes quite a troubling combination. Reassuringly, however, the Supreme Court overturned the Court of Appeal's decision on both of those points, holding that the test for inaccuracy has to be applied looking at the entire return, not just parts of it. And deliberate inaccuracy means a statement which is deliberately inaccurate. In other words, requiring an intention on the part of the taxpayer to mislead HMRC, or perhaps recklessness around that, rather than merely a deliberate statement which is inaccurate.
I've never really believed in staleness, but I'm interested in deliberate. What do you think about the Supreme Court decision here?
I think they've got it right, to be honest. I found that it was quite troubling, really, that something that was not involving an intention to mislead or something that was effectively fraudulent could enable HMRC to have a 20-year period in which to decide whether to issue a discovery assessment. I think it is correcting the law and putting things back on a more stable footing to introduce or confirm that it is absolutely necessary for that element to be present to establish the much longer time period. So overall, I think it's a very welcome decision for taxpayers. The point around there being a possibility of recklessness amounting to deliberate behaviour does leave a bit of uncertainty. But for me, that simply serves to reinforce how important it is to take care and be cognizant of the consequences of completing a return and not misleading the revenue. So overall, I think it's a very positive decision.
For what it's worth, I agree with all of that. And I would only observe that HMRC's view of when people have acted deliberately doesn't always coincide with mine. So anything that sets the bar in the right place is helpful. I'm going to skip on, still actually in the personal tax world, employment taxes, a case called Vermilion, an employment tax case specifically on employment-related securities, a split decision of the Inner House of the Court of Session, which is the Scots equivalent of the English Court of Appeal, which unexpectedly, at least from HMRC's perspective, limits the application of an HMRC-friendly deeming provision, finds on the facts that newly issued options to a director were not by reason of his directorship, it's probably going to go to the Supreme Court. Might talk about that in a bit more in a minute. But this may well not be the last word. So Mr. Noble provided services to Vermilion. Vermilion issued share options to his company. Vermilion ran into financial difficulties. It was agreed to get rid of the old share options and put in place new ones with lower value. But this was part of a restructuring in which Mr. Noble had become a director. And if those new options were provided by reason of his directorship, they'd be employment-related securities and income tax charges would apply. And quite apart from the actual reason for the options, Section 4713 of ITEPA deems securities provided by an employer to be provided by reason of the employment. And here a directorship is equivalent to an employment. So what happened? Next slide. It's an unusual case to read because the president of the Court of Session wrote the longest judgment saying that the directorship was clearly a relevant reason for the issue and that in any event, he thought the deeming provision applied. But he was not a winner. The majority was in two short judgments out the back by Lords Malcolm and Doherty. They're not quite the same, though Lord Doherty referred to substantial agreement. Both seem to support what should be orthodoxy. The judgment of Lord Justice Oliver in the 1980s case, Wicks and Firth, that when you're looking for whether something is by reason of the employment, you look for the operative clause, and that excludes some but-for causes, some situations where it wouldn't have happened but for this. Lord Malcolm took a broad view that Mr. Noble hadn't acquired anything because he had less at the end than he did at the start, but Lord Doherty didn't go there. But then both of them say that the deeming provision did not apply in the limited situation where the employment directorship is known not to be an operative reason for the grant. Now, HMRC conceded that even though the deeming provision was pretty broad and didn't have any sort of limitation built into it, that there were some situations where it wouldn't apply, where it was effectively wholly coincidental that the recipient of the security was an employee. And so that meant that a dividing line had to be drawn somewhere. But here, the FTT finding that the existing option was the operative cause, which that was what they found was critical. HMRC's position seems to have been that the interconditionality of the option and the directorship was what was enough to make the option by reason of the directorship. The troubling thing from my perspective is that they didn't argue this in an operative cause sort of way. They argued it very much on a but-for basis, and that's agreed to be too wide. So for now, this leaves, I think, real ongoing risk on amendments to employment-related security arrangements, because it demonstrates the way that HMRC will argue it if they think that the securities are too bound up with directorship. And while the litigation is ongoing, we don't necessarily have a clear decision that HMRC are wrong.
So Rupert, I think that the majority decision here feels like it's probably the right one, but the reasoning isn't terribly clear. You mentioned it might be going to the Supreme Court. What do you think is the likely outcome if it does?
I think that on actual purpose, actual reason, the Supreme Court will stick with the first tier tribunal finding that the operative purpose was to replace his prior securities. For what it's worth, I think both of the majority said something pretty conventional, that you only take deeming provisions as far as you have to, and if they produce an absurd result, then you shouldn't let them do that. You should stop. I think that on this case, where it's clear what the purpose was, I think they'll find it reasonably easy. What would be helpful is if the Supreme Court, assuming it goes, actually does something to draw the line between where, draw the line between where, as to when that deeming provision should stop, when it becomes irrational, absurd to extend it. And that may very well mean that if you are making changes to employment-related security arrangements, you have to write down explicitly what the purpose was, so that there's no doubt, so that you fit within paragraphs 60 and 67 of the Court of Appeal, or in Scotland, the Court of Session. Back to you, I think, Sarah.
Yes, thank you. So we've finished with the cases that we're going to talk about in a bit more detail. But as I mentioned at the beginning, there are some that we're going to go through at a slightly higher level because we think they're also interesting, but potentially of slightly less significance or more confined in their significance. And the first of those that I'm going to talk about is the recent Vittol decision of the First Tier Tribunal, which is a case about the interaction of diverted profits tax and corporation tax. And the background here is that several companies in the Vittol group had open corporation tax inquiries and parallel DPT review periods in respect of the same accounting periods, which is a common position for companies to be in. And the open issue was a transfer pricing one. It was found by the tribunal as a fact that HMRC had reached a conclusion on what the appropriate transfer pricing should be. Although HMRC had argued that there was some information still outstanding, the First Tier Tribunal found from the HMRC witness evidence that that wouldn't have made any difference to their view on the transfer pricing. So on the face of it, HMRC were in a position to issue a closure notice. But HMRC argued that there were reasonable grounds for not doing so, which boiled down to the fact that issuing a closure notice would have the effect of subjecting the relevant amount to corporation tax rather than DPT. And HMRC argued, consistent with their published guidance, that the DPT legislation requires taxpayers to bring profits within the scope of corporation tax rather than DPT by making an adjustment to their corporation tax returns. And it was counter to the purpose of the legislation and also outside the jurisdiction of the tribunal for the tribunal to determine that profits should be subject to corporation tax rather than DPT by ruling that a closure notice should be issued. The rub here for me is that a taxpayer is not going to make an adjustment to its return if it disagrees with HMRC's view of the appropriate transfer pricing. And in those circumstances, the taxpayer would be left paying DPT, or perhaps in those circumstances, more accurately, disputing DPT. Here in Vittol, the First Tier Tribunal ordered that closure notices should be issued. It held that the purpose of the DPT legislation was to ensure that companies pay the right amount of corporation tax on their profits. And the continuing DPT review period was not a reason to deny the issue of closure notices. This taxpayer-friendly decision clearly caused a bit of a problem for HMRC, though, because it directly contradicted HMRC's guidance and also removed quite a lot of force from the stick that DPT was supposed to represent.
Sarah, what do you think HMRC will do next? Or have they done something already?
Well, they have done something already. There was a lot of speculation, I think, about whether HMRC would appeal this decision. But actually, it was announced in the budget that to solve this problem created by the First Tier Tribunal's decision, HMRC didn't say that this was solving a problem, but that's the way I'm interpreting it. It was proposed that the DPT legislation should be amended with immediate effect from budget day to prevent HMRC from issuing a closure notice to a company with an open DPT review period, even if the tribunal had directed that a closure notice should be issued. And in that case, the closure notice would be issued after the review period had ended. So HMRC have effectively solved their problem there. That's put things back where HMRC thought things should be. And so the position in the legislation will now be consistent with HMRC's guidance. But it does feel to me quite a harsh result for taxpayers, because I personally thought that the Vittol decision was quite a sensible one. Another taxpayer-friendly decision I'm going to talk about briefly is that in Tartaruga, which is covered on the next slide, in an entirely different area. This is a case about the location of risk for insurance premium tax purposes. And you might be wondering, how relevant is this going to be to companies other than insurers? But many businesses take out insurance, for example, for damage to their premises or interruption to their business, particularly relevant during COVID. And insurers usually pass on the cost of IPT through their premiums. So it is ultimately borne by the business taking out the insurance. And the rule in the IPT context is that UK IPT does not apply to contracts of insurance where the insured risk is outside the UK. And that means that the location of risk can be critical to determining whether that IPT applies or not. In the Tartaruga case, it was concerned with the location of risk under policies which were insuring risks relating to the construction of offshore pipelines in the North Sea. And against that background, what the legal test tells you at a high level is that risks relating to buildings are located where the building is. There are a few other specific provisions, for example, in relation to travel, which are unlikely to be relevant in the corporate context. And if none of those apply, so if it doesn't relate to a building, it's not travel insurance, etc., the risk is otherwise located where the policyholder is established. So focusing on those, the key point to highlight, I think, from this case is that the correct starting point is to identify the real risk, by which I mean the uncertain event that is going to trigger a payment being made under the policy, and then to consider the location of that risk. So in the Tartaruga case, that meant looking through the fact that the loss insured was actually the payment of an excess under an insurance policy, which on the face of it you might regard as merely a financial loss, to the event that would trigger the payment of that amount, which was, in this case, damage to property located offshore. And you can see, I think, from that, that the characterisation of the risk can make all the difference in terms of whether the policy is in or out of the scope of IPT, as it did here, because the property in that case was outside the UK's territorial waters, and so outside the UK, no UK IPT applied. A couple of other points to mention very briefly, as noted on the slide, are a risk relates to a building only if there is a sufficient physical connection to it. In this case, that meant the risk of damage to something which is being transported to be attached to a building, but is not yet attached to a building, would not relate to the building. And the other point is that establishment in this context, where the policyholder is established, means a place where activities are conducted in relation to which the risk relates. So although this isn't a permanent establishment concept or a fixed establishment context like you will find in other areas of the tax code, there must still be some degree of permanence to constitute an establishment. And that will vary according to the facts, but in Tartaruga, it was held that a construction ship, effectively a construction site, for a project that was lasting more than 12 months, was held to qualify as an establishment. But the key takeaway overall, however, I think is you really need to look to what is that underlying risk.
Clause 72 of the finance bill that came out early this week is called insurance premium tax identifying location of risk. Is that a response to this?
Yes and no. So I mentioned the legal test earlier. In fact, it was noted during this case that there was a bit of a gap in the legislation in that respect. The question of where a risk is located used to be answered before the 17th of December 2009 by regulations made under the Financial Services and Markets Act, but those no longer applied to insurance contracts entered into after December 2009. The finance bill includes a clause amending the IPT legislation to plug that gap by inserting into the legislation effectively what the regulations used to say about location of risk. So the test isn't any different, it's just found in a different place now. The last case I'm going to mention is Centrica, which is an upper tribunal decision. And I wanted to flag this one because of what it says about the circumstances in which advisor fees incurred by a company carrying on investment business can be deductible as expenses of management.
So when I read the first tier tribunal decision in this case, I thought that could have some quite bad, difficult consequences. But the upper tribunal looks as though it's found for the taxpayer, at least partly.
Yes, I completely agree with that, Rupert. So the first tier tribunal had found that the company itself, the intermediate holding company in question, did not carry on management activities. And it said that those were carried on by the ultimate parent. And that decision was based on a finding that decisions about how to manage or whether to dispose of a subgroup owned by the company C were not actually taken by C's directors in their capacity as directors, but as senior managers within the broader C group. And that meant that they weren't exercising management of C. And so the related expenses that were incurred by the company were not expenses of management. Although there were some indications that the tribunal would have reached a different conclusion if the decisions of the directors had been recorded in board minutes. And what the tribunal disagreed with in the first tier tribunal's decision was essentially that conclusion that there was no management, and in particular that it was necessary formally to record the decisions of the board in order to say that there was management. What the upper tribunal said was that the individuals who were the directors were clearly participating in the strategic decision making in relation to the O business that was being disposed of, even if they were doing that informally. And that was sufficient to show that the expenditure was incurred in relation to the company's investment business, although they did note that it might be desirable for decision making and any related delegation of authority to be recorded in board minutes or correspondence. And I have to say, for me, that feels like a much more sensible decision. I think the first tier tribunal was taking an extremely hard line that in practice would be very difficult for organisations to comply with, and would mean that the expenses of management concept was not really going to be of any use to anybody. A couple of other aspects of the upper tribunal's decision that are worth mentioning. One is that whether expenses relate to the mechanics of implementation or cost of investment, and so are excluded from being deductible, is a fact-sensitive question, and the purpose of that expenditure will be key. So the distinction there is between something that relates to exercising management, making a decision, and implementing that decision, with expenses relating to the former being deductible and expenses relating to the latter not being. And on a related point, purpose is more significant than the timing. So the fact that a fee might only be payable on, and in fact contingent on, completion doesn't mean it can't still relate to services provided in connection with the decision-making piece. Excuse me. And finally, noting that capital expenditure can't be an expense of management, and that investment companies hold assets on capital account, Parliament's intention must have been, the upper tribunal thought, that not all expenditure relating to those assets is capital in nature. So the upper tribunal drew a line between expenses which don't normally recur, but have the effect of creating, enhancing, or disposing of a capital investment, which are capital, and expenditure which informs decision making and the exercise of managerial discretion, which is revenue expenditure, and so not excluded from deduction. That's everything that I was going to say about the Centrica case, so I'll hand back over to you, Rupert.
Thanks, Sarah. And that upper tribunal decision does sound like plain common sense to me, so hopefully it will stick there. I'm going to finish up for us with two pairs of cases. The first pair is on aspects of HMRC's duty, discretion of care and management of the tax system, and the limits on taxpayers' legal rights to insist that HMRC exercise it in particular ways. So the first case is Murphy, and it's worth saying that neither of these the facts may not be particularly critical for many listeners. The important thing is the public law HMRC administration principles that they outline. So Mr. Murphy was UK beneficiary of a non-UK trust. I think it was Mr. Murphy. If you're Mrs. Murphy, I apologise. And he or she wanted credit for UK tax on underlying trust income. It wasn't apparently obvious whether ESC B18 allowed this in respect of income from before the six prior tax years. ESC B18 specifically included that restriction for part of it, but not for the part that was sought to be relied on. The court found that an extra statutory concession is a document. Interpretation of documents is just what the court does. It's a legal question. And it should approach it in the normal way. So you look at all public documents available at the time of issue of the extra statutory concession. They're useful parts of the factual matrix for interpreting it. Whereas, on the other hand, anecdotal evidence of HMRC practice isn't, nor is direct HMRC practice evidence, even if it's unpublished. The court did not say that HMRC had to extend the benefit of extra statutory concession B18 in this circumstance to earlier periods. And there are two things to note. The first is that it took what is a legally robust and appropriate interpretation, in my view, of the wording, but frankly is not obvious on first reading. And would probably be not obvious on first reading to many readers, particularly non-lawyers, actually. The second thing is that, critically, they said on any view, the reading that the taxpayer sought wasn't a clear one. And so even if they were right, HMRC couldn't be held to it, because HMRC can only be held to statements which are clear, unambiguous, and devoid of relevant qualification. And this is something we talk about a lot. When you're interpreting legislation, you need to look for what the best answer is. If you're interpreting guidance and you want to get legal work out of that guidance, is my view the best one? The question is my interpretation the only one? Second case is to do with the ill-fated employment tax loan charge. Mr. Clamp had money in an EBT lent to him. When the loan charge was being trailed several years beforehand, he arranged for his loans to be repaid so as to avoid being subject to a tax charge on the loan. The loan charge has now, of course, been abolished. Mr. Clamp can't get his hands back on the money without a tax charge, and so he's miffed, because he had the money in his hands previously, and now he doesn't. He asked HMRC to agree to disregard his repayment of EBT loans. They refused. He sought judicial review. He lost. But interestingly, the discussion focused on HMRC would have had power to make that agreement, so-called AL-fired forward tax agreements that HMRC are prohibited from making. This wasn't one of those. But the court said that HMRC had no power if it's formed a proper rational view that tax would be due on any distribution or loan to Mr. Clamp after the repayment, to agree not to tax it because it's not fair. The only power that it would have to do so would be on grounds of pragmatism, on the grounds that this is an effective step for them to take as part of their primary duty of collecting the maximum tax reasonably available to them from the taxes under their care. What this kind of means in practice is it's just a reminder that if you're asking HMRC to exercise their discretion and not to charge tax, don't say it's not fair. Make the point that it would be unpragmatic for them for some reasons to collect that tax.
So two judicial review cases, Rupert. Do any of the other cases we've talked about today include some similar judicial review type arguments?
QuickFit does, or it has judicial review type facts in it. Before the debt reorganisation, QuickFit approached their CRM about it. Judging from the case, their engagement looks pretty appropriate and helpful. And the CRM confirmed that he was happy and or content with the reorganization. QuickFit had specifically asked for certainty, so they took that as meaning that HMRC weren't going to challenge it, including on an unallowable purpose basis. But there's no indication from the case that QuickFit have felt able to pursue a judicial review asking to hold HMRC to what they think they promised, and they'd have had to have started that judicial review when the closure notices were issued. The other thing about QuickFit is that the FTT went out of their way to say that they didn't think HMRC had approved the reorganisation. They thought the engagement was too light touch for that, which gives you a bit of a quandary, actually, because a lot of the time, the way to sort things out is by talking to the CRM, and it's a relationship issue. But the steer is that frequently, if you want legal traction from an HMRC steer, you need to do something more formal. Right, last one. A pair of case studies on the impact of EU law on UK VAT following Brexit, and specifically following the end of the implementation period at the end of last year. So one significant issue is that EU VAT law doesn't automatically flow into UK law anymore. It must pass through a new gateway in Section 4.2 of the EU Withdrawal Act, and it will only do so if the VAT issue is of a kind with one ruled on before the end of 2020 or addressed or to be addressed in UK litigation, which had at least started by then. That's tricky. The meaning of a kind isn't clear. There's significant debate on it. It raises difficult questions like, does the CJEU decision in Danske Bank, even though it came after we'd severed our ties with the EU, still prohibit the UK VAT system from allowing non-UK branches into VAT groups? Difficult question. The other practically interesting question is, what will the UK courts do with EU VAT cases, even where they pass through that gateway? Will they stick with them, or will they surreptitiously start ignoring them? And I've got a little contrast here. The first case is Balhousie, which is arguably a case on surreptitiously ignoring. Supreme Court decision from Scotland. Taxpayer owned a care home. It had acquired it in a zero-rated transaction from a developer. It did a sale and lease back. If that was a disposal of its entire interest, it lost the benefit of the zero rating. There was a CJEU case pretty much directly considering this sort of issue, though in the context of what's a supply rather than in the context of whether you disposed of your entire interest, what was the nature of the supply. Lady Arden, in a minority, thought it was a very good idea to go through the CJEU case. Lord Briggs, delivering a speech for 4-1 majority, just didn't go there. Said it wasn't interesting. This is a straightforward case on UK statutory interpretation. And in any event, because it was a zero rating case, you would very rarely need to go to EU law. Now, he might be right, but coming so soon after the end of the transitional period, it was quite a striking judgment. It's not all one-way traffic, though, because as you see on the next slide, and I'll do this quickly, target a very granular grind through the case law on specific aspects of the finance exemption. This case, and this is a point which people other than me, like Sab Singh at One Crown Office Row, Public Law and VAT QC, makes particularly clearly, is one which absolutely sticks to the old orthodoxy. Were loan administrations exempt? The court ground through domestic and CJEU authorities. Having done that, I thought it was bound to give precedence to decisions of the CJEU and found the exemption didn't apply. What does this kind of tension in judicial approach mean for cases like Redrow or multi-party supplies? A UK decision, House of Lords decision, which hasn't been totally reflected in the CJEU case law. Honestly, it's just something we're going to have to watch.
Rupert, I hear there's going to, or may at least, be a further hearing in the target case about whether the Court of Appeal is now free to depart from CJEU case law. What do you think about that one?
So that's another interesting question. Clearly they are. Clearly they are post-Brexit, so post-Brexit fact patterns, so end of 2020. But what about for when they're determining the law pre the end of the transitional period? No part of the EU Withdrawal Act says in terms of it's changing the law that applied pre-Brexit. But there's a real textual view that, as you say, it changes how UK courts should decide post-Brexit, case it on pre-Brexit periods. And it permits them, possibly in the same way that, it definitely textually in the same way and possibly factually in the same way as the Supreme Court can diverge from its decisions, permits them to diverge from CJU decisions, even on decisions for pre-Brexit fact patterns. That would be a retrospective change of law. It's quite interesting, but that's what Target are asking the Court of Appeal to rule on.
I'm sure there's much more that we could say, but regretfully, that's all we have time to discuss today. Thank you for taking the time to watch this webinar. We hope that you found it useful.